This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Hattie Caraway of Arkansas was the first woman elected to the U.S. Senate, and that was in 1932, and only after being appointed to the seat when her husband, Thaddeus, died. 44 women have been U.S. senators since the branch was established in 1789. And it's still no picnic for women who become members of a club they were never really meant to join. There was a males-only swimming pool, a paucity of women's restrooms, and a long list of sexist comments and even groping from randy old-school members of the distinguished Senate. With so few women serving, they're still largely treated as intruders. Liza Mundy wrote The Secret History of Women in the Senate for Politico. And Liza, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
Well, some of these stories, I mean, even recent ones of women trying to bust in sound shockingly archaic. Take Kay Hagan, just wanting to take a swim in the Senate pool. What happened?
Well, when Senator Hagan was elected from North Carolina in 2008 and came up to the Senate before she had been sworn in, members typically come up and they get shown around and acclimated. And she was being shown the Senate gym and caught a whiff of swimming pool. And she said, "Oh, is there a pool?" And they said, "Well, yes, but it's men only." And when she asked why, they responded that some of the male swimmers like to swim in the buff. They like to swim naked. And she got that changed. She had to push back. But that was 2008, which is just extraordinary.
It does sound like a story from the 1950s somehow. More well-known is the updating of the women's bathrooms, which was, I guess, a great cause for joy among female senators.
Yes, and it's extraordinary, like the fight for facilities. It's extraordinary how long that has taken. You mentioned Hattie Caraway back in the, pretty early part of the 19th century. Well, she had to use the public restroom along with the tourists to the Capitol because there was nothing for women close to the floor. So more recently, there was a ladies' restroom close to the floor, but it was so small. And even with 20 women senators, which is only one-fifth of the Senate, certainly not a big number, but even with 20, it was starting to get very crowded, and the women had to really fight to get expanded facilities. So it has taken a remarkably long time for some basic changes to be made.
Well, those are structural things. Behavioral infractions are an entirely other thing, and sometimes tolerated or even laughed at among other male senators. Can you tell us some stories about that?
I mean, it's important to point out, up until the late 1980s, there had only ever been one or two women senators at any given time. So it had really been an all-male institution for more than 100 years. And when women started coming in still quite small numbers in the early 1990s, there were many male senators who were quite wonderful. And the women, want to make that point. But there were still male senators who were predatory. I mean, Strom Thurmond was notorious for groping staffers. I mean, up until then, women in the Senate had been largely in subordinate positions, and I think women had been forced to just sort of tolerate roving interests from senators. But even when women senators started coming in, I mean, there was a widely reported story that when Senator Patty Murray was elected, that at one point Strom Thurmond tried to grope her breast on the Senate elevator. And then when Susan Collins of Maine came in the late 90s, she was told to avoid getting on an elevator alone with him. And she recounted to me an incident where she looked up and realized that they were heading toward the same elevator. And she said that she made a U-turn and just went up the stairs, just a sort of a quick decision. And one of her male colleagues just sort of laughed because he knew exactly what she was doing. As she later said to me, you know, he was given a pass, and we all gave him a pass because he was older and regarded as a person of a different generation and had been around forever. But there were a number of legislators who, up until the 1990s, were given passes.
Well, is that the strategy, I guess, for lack of strategy, just wait until the old dinosaurs die off?
Well, I think that was true in some cases, but you may recall that in the 1990s, there was also the protracted episode in which Senator Bob Packwood, there were allegations by nearly 20 women that he had made advances or accosted them. And there was a prolonged, agonizing number of years in which the Senate wrestled with what to do about these allegations. And ultimately, the Ethics Committee recommended that he be expelled, and he resigned instead. And of course, before that, there was the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill hearings in which she made allegation of sexual harassment when Justice Thomas was up for confirmation. And there was the indelible public televised image of an all-male, all-white Judiciary Committee listening to her charges and, you know, on a certain level, just not getting it. So I think there were some senators who were given passes. But what you saw in the 1990s were some very public, very kind of agonizing situations in which the Senate was sort of reckoning with what had been acceptable in the past and what was no longer acceptable.
And those are two events that you point out as really big turning points in the numbers of or the motivation for women who are seeking the Senate. But still, what are we looking at? 20 women now currently holding seats in the Senate?
20 women now. And in fact, there have now been 46 women senators because we lost two in the midterms and gained two in the midterms. So we can now say that 46 women have served or are serving in the Senate, but the current number remains at 20. So that's one-fifth of the whole Senate body.
And you point out in your article that most of the women in the 20th century who served briefly was upon the death of a husband. Now, how did that practice come about?
So, and Hattie Carryway would be one example, but it happened any number of times after her tenure that if a lawmaker died, if a senator died while he was in office, his wife would often be sort of drafted by state political officials to basically keep his seat warm until an actual elected successor, could be elected. But the assumption was always that it would be a male senator and that the wife was just there in a temporary capacity. In Hattie Carraway's case, she was an early example of a woman after a year deciding, you know what, I'd like to run for election. The expectation in Arkansas was that she would step aside after a year, and she decided not to. And she kept a fascinating diary in which she made really sort of tart and interesting observations. She obsessively analyzed what her male colleagues were wearing, what their, you know, their color of their spats that day or the color of their whiskers that day. She was kind of, she was very sharp-eyed, but you could see in her diary a growing enjoyment of being a member of Congress. And also, she needed the money. She needed the salary. I mean, back then, all indications are that a woman was paid as much as a man when she served in the Senate, and that, of course, was unusual for women back then. There weren't very many occupations where a woman could expect to make as much as a man, and her husband had left her in debt, and she had lost her house. So she needed the job, and she needed the money, but she also increasingly enjoyed what she was doing. But she was an anomaly.
Well, we're pulling back the curtain to perhaps one of the country's most exclusive clubs, the U.S. Senate, an old boy network for a couple of centuries. We're speaking with Liza Mundy. She is a contributing editor at Politico, and she wrote The Secret History of Women in the Senate. So we heard about Hattie Caraway, who really did start to make a difference or really took to the Senate. There is another woman, Margaret Chase Smith, who really became in many ways one of the first modern female senators and the first to denounce McCarthy's tactics on the Senate floor. Was she regarded as a woman foremost or a senator?
Margaret Chase Smith typically would say, "I was elected to be a senator, not a woman senator." So she would stress that she was a senator just like everybody else, understandably. But as one of the Senate historians, and the Senate historians are such wonderful resources of history, Betty Coed, who was one of the historians, pointed out to me that behind the scenes, Margaret Chase Smith did a lot for women. She was a member of the Armed Services Committee, and she spoke up for benefits for women military veterans, you know, from the Second World War. And historian Coed said, you know, that she was really the first person to take up the cause of women in the military and their right for benefits and things like that, recognizing their service. And so although Margaret Chase Smith might have, again, understandably wanted to stress that she was a regular, effective senator just like everybody else, she did press women's issues strategically. And one of the reasons that Maine has a tradition of electing women to the Senate is because of the influence of Margaret Chase Smith. Susan Collins speaks movingly about going to the Senate as part of a youth program when she was in high school, and the fact that, to her astonishment, Margaret Chase Smith spent 2 hours talking to her about the satisfactions of public service and public life and what you can achieve. And Senator Collins, when I asked her, you know, was there anybody else on the trip, she mentioned that there was a young man on the trip with her as well, and she did not recall Margaret Chase Smith spending that kind of time with him.
Well, I guess the fear is that with too many female senators, women's issues will get pushed to the floor, right? The idea that there would be a sort of female caucus. Give us a sense of what's going on in terms of a women's caucus today when there's so much partisan division within the Senate.
Right. So the history of the women in the Senate includes a lot of solidarity and I wouldn't say secret meetings, but regular off-the-record meetings, which has an interesting origin. After the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill spectacle, there were a number of women elected to the Senate, Patty Murray, Carol Moseley Braun, Barbara Boxer, Senator Feinstein, also from California. And Barbara Mikulski, up until then, had been either the only senator or one of just a two. And so she was ready when all these new women Democrats came into the Senate. She was ready for them with written instructions about how to run an office, how to get on a committee, all the sorts of things that she felt a newcomer needed to know. And she got together with them over breakfast and gave them practically a manual of how to be a senator. And this tradition has been handed down between the women. I was told that when Senator Gillibrand came into office, Senator Feinstein did that for her because they both have big states and have to run big offices. So it wasn't just how to run an office, it was how to run a big office in a big state. And also in the 90s, along the way, there were times when the Republican and Democratic women in the Senate really would work together on issues having to do with women's health, having to do with women's economic security. The women senators were really able to band together on issues like that and push them forward. But I do think that in this current partisan, really partisan environment, it is still true that the women can reach across the aisle to each other maybe more often than the men, but it is becoming harder, and particularly in the midterms with, you know, hotly contested elections for control of the Senate. You know, there were instances of women senators campaigning against each other.
Right here in New Hampshire, Kelly Ayotte and Jean Shaheen.
Yeah, and that represents a shift from times past, but I think an inevitable one. And, you know, ideally, I think we'd all like to see, or many of us would like to see, a Senate with 50 women in it. And in that case, right, I mean, partisan division is going to become inevitable. Campaigning against each other will become inevitable. So, you know, something may have been lost in the current environment, the sort of solidarity of yore. But it may be that we are gradually moving toward a period of time, right, when the women are just like the men, and hopefully a time someday when there are just as many women as men.
Just as long as their behavior isn't the same.
Right, in many respects, yeah.
Well, Liza Mundy, fascinating read. Thank you so much for joining us.
That was a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Liza Mundy, contributing editor at Politico. She is the program director at the New America Foundation. And you can find a link to read her article, The Secret History of Women in the Senate. There are all sorts of interesting web-only extras there, too. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Now from women in the U.S. Senate to women in the world of sports. Up next, we're going to hear the story of a small group of American female athletes who traveled to France in the 1920s to participate in the first international track meet for women. The race is on when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Starting with earning the right to vote, the 1920s was a big decade for women in America. After filling in for soldiers deployed during World War I, women remained in the workforce, and their numbers grew from 7 million in 1919 to almost 11 million a decade later. On the social front, liberated flappers cut their hair into bobs and boozed and danced the night away in jazz clubs. Flickering signs of emancipation, except that is in the world of athletics. But a small group of women tried to change that. In 1922, 15 American women traveled to France to participate in the first international track meet for women. While they may not have had the backing of the country, they made great strides towards women's equality in sports. Backstory producer Kelly Jones brings us the story.
At 21, Lucille Godbold stood just over 6 feet tall.
I think she probably looked more like her father than she looked like her mother.
This is Jane Tuttle, a librarian at Columbia College in South Carolina. Lucille Godbold wasn't especially beautiful by 1920s standards, but that didn't matter. She had a wicked arm.
At a track meet in her senior year, she broke the American record for the shot put. And so she was invited in May to take part in the tryouts for the first international track meet for women that was going to Paris in August.
That track meet was a scheme designed by the French to establish women's track and field as an official Olympic event. In the early 20s, there were no standard Olympic sports for women. Some years, there would be golf or tennis. Others, there might be swimming or archery. There weren't any track and field events. At home, the American Physical Education Association, the APEA, discouraged women from track and field because they believed that lots of running and jumping could knock women's reproductive systems out of whack, making them unable to fulfill their primary social role as mothers. Competitive sports were thought to be too intense for educated ladies.
They thought emotionally it was very tough on women to lose. And if you were in the elite of society who were actually going to college, track and field was not something that you needed to get involved in.
But Dr. Harry Eaton Stewart, an American physiotherapist, didn't buy those claims. He wanted to prove the APEA wrong. He asked for help from a group called the Amateur Athletic Union, who governed sports outside of schools, but they refused him. So he held his own tryouts, and his athletes organized bake sales to fund the trip. On August 1st, 1922, Lucille Godbold and 14 other women set sail for Paris.
This is Lucille talking about the meet. Just before it began, each team marched around the field with one member carrying her nation's flag. I was chosen to carry Old Glory, and believe me, I was proud to lead that American team around the track.
5 teams competed that day: Great Britain, France, Czechoslovakia, Switzerland, and the American underdogs. Though the other teams had all competed internationally before, the women on the U.S. team had hardly any practice competing at home. In front of a crowd of 20,000 people, Lucille Godbold earned 6 medals in 7 events and set a new world record in shot put, unseating the French champion.
She says, "The announcer took me around and introduced me to all those thousands of people in French. He might have been cussing me out for all I know, but as everybody clapped, I reckon it was all okay. I can see those Americans yelling now. They opened their mouths so wide I was scared to death for fear the sun would warp their ribs or blister their tonsils."
The U.S. team came in 2nd overall, losing only to Great Britain. The team's successes should have convinced the APEA that women could achieve more than society had planned for them, and that women could handle competition.
But actually went in the opposite direction. The physical education directors sort of dug in their heels even more. A lot of high schools and colleges suspended their track and field programs, and they sort of set out to put an end to track and field.
The team's successes in Paris did prove their point to the AAU, the group that governs sports outside of schools, who began to fund women's track and field teams the very next year. That paved the way for athletic superstars like Babe Diedrichsen and Stella Walsh in the 30s and 40s to rise to fame without the help of college programs. And the French scheme eventually worked. 6 years after the meet in Paris, 5 track and field events for women were included in the Olympics in Amsterdam. But what should have been a no-brainer was a struggle. Instead of catapulting American women into the international sports arena, participating in the first international track meet for women was a small hop, step, and jump on the road to equal play.
And that story came to us from producer Kelly Jones in Backstory with the American History Guys. Up next, women's rights in the workplace. We're going to distinguish fact from fiction and take an unvarnished look at the state of maternity leave in the U.S. That's after the news, when Word of Mouth continues here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. What does the U.S. have in common with Lesotho, Swaziland, and Papua New Guinea? Well, we share the dubious status of being the 4 countries that do not provide paid maternity leave. At last week's State of the Union address, President Obama asked Congress to pass measures allowing federal workers to earn up to 6 days of sick time that could be used as paid family leave. Judith Barnett is a former senior government official. She's now a lawyer and a consultant in international trade. She considers America's unwillingness to provide women time off to have children an outrage and wrote about it for the Huffington Post. Judith, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, so what is the current maternity leave policy for federal workers?
Well, in 1993, President Clinton signed the Family and Medical Leave Act. And what that allowed was 12 weeks of unpaid leave for employees, either to care for their newborn or for loved ones. Not a lot for people like single parents, et cetera, who can't take unpaid leave, and not a lot for anybody.
Well, that's the federal policy. How about in the private sector in general? What is the paid maternity leave policy?
Pretty weak. It's about 11% of all non-federal or non-government workers can take paid maternity leave of various kinds. You know, on one hand, that's a good thing because 11% get it. On the other hand, some employers have told me that they'll think twice before hiring young women because they'll just take off and take their paid maternity leave.
Wow. Well, we know how pro-family Congress is. How do members of Congress in general feel about paid family or maternity leave?
Basically, they say they like it, but they don't vote for the legislation. So there is a very good bill out by Senator Gillibrand and Representative DeLorio that would allow 12 weeks of paid parental leave. And supposedly everybody, the 2012 poll says that 88% of Democrats and 73% of Republicans support it, but nobody shows up for a vote. So I guess it sort of is, but it isn't.
So that's proposed legislation by two female Democrats, if I've got it right. Now, how would that be paid for?
Well, they want it to be paid for by a payroll tax. And this is actually something that's done in a couple of the states. There are just a couple of exceptions where family leave is paid through payroll taxes. It's a possibility. I mean, maybe 0.2% or 0.1% could be increased on the payroll tax. And there are many, many ingenious ways of finding money. I've lived in Washington for 40 years, and there are some brilliant people who spend time thinking of brilliant proposals for lots of other things. But when it comes to pregnant mothers and children who I think are our future, people kind of go mute.
Okay. So the president at the State of the Union address, talking to both houses of Congress, and the president at the State of the Union address proposed this 6 days of sick time for that could be used as family leave. Now, how determined is he to get that through? Would this be something that would actually become an item for an executive order, for example?
Well, I mean, I think there are ways that he could implement these types of policies. I don't see it. I mean, this is the sixth year. I've been in three different administrations, and you do kind of get a lame duck once the election for 2016 really kicks off. There's not a lot that they're going to be doing, and I don't see real fire in the belly for paid maternity leave anywhere here.
We're talking with Judith Barnett. She is a former government employee, in fact, high-level government employee, and now is a business consultant and a lawyer. She wrote in the Huffington Post, an American outrage having babies on sick leave, wondering why the U.S. is one of only four countries in the world to not give women paid leave to have children. Well, you wrote about a little history of subsidized care for children and families, noting that the last time it was done on any wide scale was during World War II. Can you give us the details?
Yeah, I mean, in World War II, women needed to go into the factories. I mean, I lived in Detroit after World War II, and women still talked about those happy days where they could pack off and go help the war effort. Well, they also had children. So what the government did was to develop federally subsidized child care centers. And then the private sector took over. So they supplemented, like the Kaiser factory. I had wonderful child care centers with a doctor on call at all times, with nurses, with food. And this doesn't all need to be subsidized by the U.S. government. It needs to be seeded by the U.S. government and let private industry supplement it.
Okay, so after Rosie the Riveter returned home, so did the subsidized child care.
Right.
Another proposal in 1972. What happened then?
Well, that was a proposal under the Nixon administration, and it was in 72. The Congress passed, with pretty strong bipartisan support, something called the Comprehensive Child Care Development Act. So this would have been a national network of federally funded child care centers. But President Nixon was having none of it. But his wording was what really depicted a lot of the thought of that time. He said, implementing a communal approach to child rearing would have family weakening implications.
Uh-huh. Yes, of course, that's what they do in Russia, right?
Right. And let me just say that, you know, The reality now is that 63% of families with kids have either two working parents or a single parent. The majority of families, a big majority now, don't have a stay-at-home parent to provide child care. And the people hit really the worst are families below the poverty line. They spend 30% of their income on child care, whereas those above the poverty line spend 8%.
Judith, you were once in government, we noted, but now you work as a lawyer and a consultant in international trade, and you specialize in the Middle East. I'm curious, you know, what do your colleagues in the Middle East think when you talk to them about America's maternity leave policy?
Well, as I've said in the article, it was just such an ironic statement when I think it was actually a male colleague who said that the next time my American friends talk about our deplorable status of women, I'm going to tell them that I think what he said, Arab monarchies don't demand that women be sick to deliver the future. I mean, there are all sorts of things, problems in countries throughout the Middle East, but all of them allow paid maternity leave. All of them honor pregnancy. They honor pregnant women, and they want their women to be strong at least during the time. I mean, there are problems with women working and women driving and stuff and so on and so on in some of those countries, but they at least see this moment of pregnancy as something that's critical to their countries.
Well, Judith Barnett, thank you for speaking with us.
You're just more than welcome. Thank you.
Judith Barnett is a lawyer and consultant in international trade specializing in the Middle East. She wrote An American Outrage, Having Babies on Sick Leave for the Huffington Post. You can find a link to read it for yourself. It's at wordofmouthradio.org. Think back to the very first photograph you've seen of yourself. Chances are it shows a pudgy, chubby-cheeked infant wearing its very first onesie. But these days, more and more babies are being captured on film before they have their first feeding or even swaddling. Rebecca Shear brings us the story of a photographer on the front lines of childbirth.
Washington, D.C. resident Emily Goodstein has been to more hospitals than most people.
I've been to GW Hospital, Virginia Hospital Center, Sibley, and Holy Cross Hospital.
But she hasn't been a patient or a doctor or a nurse. No, she's been...
These are the photos from baby May's arrival.
Aww. A photographer.
Every time I go through the photos, I cry just as much as I did at the birth itself.
Emily's part of a growing movement of birth photographers. The International Association of Professional Birth Photographers reports having more than 860 members in 24 countries, all hired by expectant moms to capture their labor and delivery process on camera.
So this is a picture we're looking at right now of Joanna and her baby and then her doula with the doula's hand sort of on Joanna's leg. And I have noticed that I actually get a picture quite similar to this at all births. It's funny the types of things that repeat themselves.
Emily's start in professional photography came with another milestone life cycle event, weddings.
Photographing weddings was fun and people were happy, but I was getting a little burnt out. And I came across a blog, actually of a photographer who's based in Utah, who had photographed a birth. And I thought, this is weird. People have professional photographers at their birth?
That was 4 years ago.
And I know that because the first baby that I photographed being born is now four.
The birth happened at Virginia Hospital Center.
It was a beautiful birth. And I walked out of the hospital. And I remember I was standing in the driveway of Virginia Hospital Center with all my gear. And I had amniotic fluid on my sweatpants. And I felt like I was so sort of on my purpose.
Since then, Emily's had 20-some birth clients, including the mother whose photos we were looking at earlier, Annandale resident Joanna Eddy, who had her first home birth in the wee small hours of the morning last month.
I could not believe it. I didn't think I could do it.
But you did, and you were heroic and speedy.
I thought I was going to be at the hospital, honestly.
Emily Goodstein knows some parents may not feel comfortable bringing a professional photographer into their homes or delivery rooms. But as Joanna Eddy relaxes on her bed nursing her newborn for the very first time, she tells me she wouldn't have had it any other way.
It's just this beautiful, monumental time.
And I think that to be able to look back and see that in photos will make a lot of difference in the processing and the healing that I think all women do, regardless of their birth experience. So I think that we'll really cherish them more so than I even think in this moment when I'm able to really think about what just happened.
Emily Goodstein aims to stay as in this moment as possible so she can tell a more complete birth story.
I usually will have spoken with the client in advance and I know exactly what they're looking for. And I don't guarantee ever a specific photograph, but I try to weave the photos together to tell the story of early in the labor and meeting the baby for the first time and the siblings meeting for the first time and all that good stuff.
Still, though, she's clear what her priorities are.
I always say to the care team, my priority is for you to be able to do your jobs. My second priority is to get photos. I want to be the second priority, right? My first priority clearly is healthy mom and healthy baby.
Which is why she takes certain precautions.
Whenever I meet a new member of a care team, I always say, hey there, I'm Emily. I'm the birth photographer. I was hired by the parents to be here. Please let me know if I'm in the way. Are you comfortable if you're in the background of a few photos? And, you know, I won't take it personally if you have to elbow me out of the way. So I try to be extra respectful in that regard.
Emily's captured many a birth on film, but she hasn't always been allowed to document the actual delivery.
Every hospital has a different policy, and every doctor or midwife has a different policy. So there have been two deliveries that have resulted in C-section, and I've given my camera to the dad or to the doula. I did recently also have a twin client who labored in a labor and delivery room, but then pushed in an OR in case there were any complications. And so I wasn't actually allowed in the OR.
And yet, she says, the inherently unexpected nature of things makes her love her job all the more.
There is that thrill when, you know, a mom is pushing and her baby is born. And even I had one client this fall who actually caught her baby. And I have a beautiful photo of her sort of lifting the baby out of her. So, yes, I would love to be there when the baby is coming out. But if that's not possible, we can still get really beautiful photos.
And the truth is, that's actually what happened with Joanna Eddy in Annandale. As Emily does with all her clients, she put herself on call 2 weeks before and after Joanna's estimated delivery date.
When I'm on call, I always have a bag ready, clear memory cards, charged batteries, high-protein snacks. The longest time I've been with a client is 36 hours.
So she was totally ready to go. But remember what Joanna said about thinking she was going to be at the hospital? Well, this was her first home birth, something she'd really wanted after delivering her first child in a hospital. But once her water broke, she got kind of nervous, started having second thoughts, and one thing led to another. The birth team focused on calming her down. And the labor happened so quickly that the next thing you know, they were calling Emily to tell her it's a girl. As Emily explained during our early morning drive to Annandale, this was only the second time she'd missed a delivery.
The other one was born while I was parked in my car. So that one is in the gray area. Right? Because I was on...
You were technically there.
Exactly. Yeah. I was there. I just didn't have my camera on.
This time she did have her camera on for quite a lot, like the umbilical cord burning ceremony Joanna's birth team did in lieu of a cord cutting.
That's some serious cordage, girlfriend.
And the moment 3-year-old big sister Vivian met baby May for the very first time.
You want to come see her? You gotta be really careful. She's
my baby.
It is your baby.
It's my baby.
It's moments like these, Emily Goodstein says, that make the whole thing so magically worthwhile.
Every time I'm at a birth, I see it as a celebration of a woman making a choice about her body, or a series of choices about her body. So when and how many children to have, and how to bring children into the world. And the fact that I get to be there to celebrate that, I actually feel like it's an honor when people allow me to be with them on the day that they meet their child.
And what's more, she says, to help them remember so many little things about their big day. I'm Rebecca Shear. Rebecca Shear is host of Metro Connection on WAMU in Washington, D.C., and we'd love to hear from you. How would you feel about bringing a professional photographer into your home or delivery room during labor? Is it a moment that should be captured on film or should remain private? Tell us what you think on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Well, first comes love, then comes marriage, and then comes the old baby carriage. Then, for at least half of married couples, comes divorce. Or does it? Debunking the divorce rate myth. That's when Word of Mouth returns. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 50% of marriages end in divorce, right? That statistic is so often quoted that we don't question it, only it's not true and never has been. Data shows that marriages splitting up are on the decline and have been since the 1970s and 80s when the divorce rate peaked. Still, the myth of the 1 out of 2 marriages ending in divorce persists. So here to help us sift through some of the numbers and why we can't seem to shake the 50% divorce rate is Claire Kane Miller, New York Times reporter covering tech and gender and work and family for The Upshot at the New York Times website. Claire, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the actual current rate of divorce?
It's hard to say the current rate each year, but if the trends continue that we are seeing right now, 2/3 of marriages will never involve a divorce, meaning only 1/3 will.
Why the confusion over the divorce rate or reliance on this tried and true 50% statistic? Is the data confusing?
There was a time, as you mentioned, in the late 1970s and early 1980s when the divorce rate really peaked. And that 1 in 2 marriages end in divorce data point just stuck in our collective minds. But it wasn't true before that, and it hasn't been true since then. In fact, the divorce rate has been declining for 3 decades. The data is a little bit hard to sift through because states collect divorce records in different ways, and some marriages, of course, end in the death of a spouse. So it is a little bit hard to sift through. But the economists who are looking most closely at that at this say, at this point, 2/3 of marriages will actually make it.
Any theories about the uptick or the sharp uptick of the divorce rate in the 70s and 80s? What was going on?
Well, before then, people were marrying with the same ideas in mind, meaning men were looking for a homemaker and women were looking for a breadwinner. They found what they were looking for and their marriages tended to work out. Of course, then we had the feminist revolution in the 70s, and a lot of things changed. Women expected men to do more at home, and often women were working out of the home themselves. But a lot of people were stuck in these 1950s or 1960s marriages, and they looked around and they said, I signed up for this, but I don't want it anymore. I want what we're seeing in the feminist revolution. So that ended up leading to the ending of a lot of marriages. Now today, social scientists say, people are again marrying with the same expectations in mind, which is that there will be more sharing of housework and childcare. Women will probably work outside the home. And because people are on the same page again, their marriages are lasting.
What about the number of people getting married? Fewer marriages, fewer divorces. How does that factor into the data now?
That's definitely an important piece of it, is that fewer people are marrying now overall. The marriage rate in the United States is declining, and part of that probably means that fewer marriages that aren't going to work out end up happening. For example, there are fewer shotgun marriages. There are many, many more single mothers who don't get married simply because they were pregnant, and that probably means that they're less likely to get divorced because a shotgun marriage might not have been as strong as it could be in the first place. So that's part of it, but there really is a bigger underlying trend here, which is that even among the people who do choose to get married, divorces are going down.
I'm also reading a lot or hearing things about people getting married later in life. Does that have any determining force on whether or not people stay married?
Absolutely. So right now, men are getting married at age 27 on average, women at age 26. In some places, it's even later. That is much, much older than it was in the 50s. In the 50s, the median age for women was 20, and for men, it was 23. And what that means, social scientists say, is that people are getting to know themselves a lot better, getting to know their potential partners a lot better, having more time to date, potentially living together before they get married. And all of this means that they're more likely to choose the partner who they can spend the rest of their lives with, as opposed to making a more immature choice.
Is this decline in divorce rates over the last 20 years spread out among the population or just within certain demographics?
Well, this is one of the most troubling things about the data, which is that the decline in the divorce rate and the rise in family stability is really among college-educated people who tend to have higher incomes. Hmm. For working-class people who might not have graduated from college, the divorce rate is still pretty high. People are really worried about this because the inequality in our country, it seems, goes way beyond how much money people are making, but really means that that there are differences in the stability and happiness of families. In some cases, some of the researchers who I talked to who have studied working-class families say that because the men are still in larger percentages out of work after the recession, that really is not good for family stability. Women don't necessarily have the resources to have, you know, they say, another mouth to feed in addition to their children. And men don't necessarily feel like they're performing the breadwinner role that they want to. And that's really causing a lot of turmoil.
Hmm. Well, what do you think, Claire, that this 50% of marriages end in divorce myth persist, despite, you know, articles like you wrote that have been written for 20 years now and the efforts of social scientists who say that the data just doesn't support it?
Well, for one, it's just one of those easy statistics. People just say it all the time. If you listen to the news, whenever a celebrity gets divorced, people just say 1 in 2 marriages end in divorce, and it's easy. I also think another reason is that think of the young people who are now marrying for the first time now. They were the same people who were raised in the 70s and early 80s, and their parents did get divorced at that rate. So there are a lot of people who are now for the first time thinking of marriage for themselves who were raised in the peak divorce era, and that's very much on their mind.
Claire Kane Miller, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Claire Kane Miller, she covers tech and gender and work and family for the New York Times website, The Upshot. You'll find a link to read her article, The Divorce Surge is Over, but the Myth Lives On. It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for listening today. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us or send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more of them tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
With help from our interns,
Fiona Shea
and Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.